The following podcast is edited from the live Voices of Montana program, Montana's original statewide radio talk show that's heard Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Contact your local radio station if you'd like to hear the program live in your area and it's currently not available. The show is also streamed live on voicesofmontana.com.
Well, they finally released the Kraken. Or did they? Sidney Powell, who's a former federal prosecutor, made 30 allegations of electoral fraud going into the holiday weekend. We've been following the story. We'll catch you up to date. She called it earlier on the Kraken on steroids, which it just blows my mind. I can't even fathom a Kraken on steroids. But nonetheless, we'll see if this suit is part of that. And then there's a fair question that a lot of landowners are asking. How does the state of Montana better support the working lands that support wildlife? We'll have that and more up today on Voices of Montana.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio. From Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now, a man who loves his moose, but not that kind of moose. It's Tom Schultz.
What? I'm confused.
It's National Moose Day.
It is?
Yes, not like the
moose for my hair, because you've seen my hair.
Not even that moose.
Yeah. No, it's an actual big animal moose.
No, edible moose. Not edible. You get
There's an edible. Never mind. Thank you, Josh Rath. And let me ask you this question. Can you even fathom a Kraken on steroids?
No, but we should release it.
That goes to infinity and beyond. That is a concept that it shouldn't even be allowed. We shouldn't be allowed to ponder that. That, by the way, came from Sidney Powell, a statement from her, as she had talked about this lawsuit that she finally released going into the holiday weekend. We're going to talk about that here in just a little bit. As I say, we have been following this story an awful lot because election integrity matters. All right. It's not about President Trump or presumed President-elect Biden. It's about cleaning up the system so we can have complete confidence in our election process. And so that's why we're following this, and we'll talk about it here in just a little bit. Tom Schultz alongside. How was your holiday? Good? I hope it was good. Want to welcome new listeners on KFLN in Baker, Montana, Real Country 960. Great to have you here. Join in on the conversation at 866-627-5483 or text us a message here, which we folks are doing an awful lot more of that. We'd love to hear from you as well and get that interaction going. It's so important, but text us a message here or a comment. We'll put newsmakers on the air and we'd love to have you just quiz them. Hold them accountable. 781-627-5483. 5483. Yep, it's Voices of Montana, two decades strong, working on three. Want to just start right off with this Sidney Powell lawsuit. And there's a few things here. I'm taking this one off of Epic Times, which is going to be a publication that leans right, quite a bit right, as a matter of fact. But I find them credible in their reporting. So Sidney Powell's lawsuit made 30 allegations of electoral fraud and other illegal and irregular activities. You know what? What I'm going to do first off here is play this soundbite from Sidney. This was when she had her press conference, I think it was a week ago, last Thursday, with Giuliani. And she had talked about what she had seen in uncovering this. And again, maybe for some of you new listeners in Baker, I am not proposing that there was a massive election fraud. We're just covering this issue. All right. But the quivering in her voice, and this again was a week ago when she announced that she's going to be filing this lawsuit. I'll get into the details here in just a bit. But if you saw the online conversation regarding that, people who know and worked with Sidney Powell, a former federal prosecutor, when she got to this point of her discussion in the press conference, her voice was quivering. She was very emotional. And that told a lot of people who knew Sidney how engaged she is in this and how serious she finds these allegations.
This is stunning, heartbreaking, infuriating, and the most unpatriotic acts I can even imagine for people in this country to have participated in any way, shape, or form. And I want the American public to know right now that we will not be intimidated. American patriots are fed up with the corruption from the local level to the highest level of our government, and we are going to take this country back. We are not going to be intimidated. We are not going to back down. We are going to clean this mess up now.
Really don't know much about Sidney Powell and didn't know much about her at that time when I witnessed that, but you could see when you have somebody who is as studied and as qualified and as experienced as a Sidney Powell, and they are at a press conference, and you can hear in the tone of their voice that sort of thing. These kind of professionals don't quiver when they talk. And so it just alluded to me how serious she finds these allegations. Most are in her lawsuit that she filed in Georgia specifically. And there's a few of them here that I'm going to go through for you. Okay. The allegations, and they're mostly based on witness and expert statements. And there's a lot of people who have written out affidavits that is swearing under penalty of perjury that they witness these things, that these things are true. It's testimony, and it's allowed. As a matter of fact, a Nevada judge has agreed to hear, finally, this came down over the weekend as well, Trump campaign evidence of alleged voter fraud in Nevada. It's going to be an evidentiary hearing. So some of this evidence is going to get out. It's got to be a lot. The burden of proof is on the people making these allegations, and some have gone some have gone far, too far over the line. Judges have thrown out a lot of those, but there are some cases that are coming forward, and I'm updating you on that today. Before I get lost, Sidney Powell, here's some of her allegations in the suit. The software used by Dominion Machines was accessed by agents of malicious actors such as China and Iran. Very, very, I don't want to say unbelievable because it is believable, but incredible claims. And you've got to back those up if you're going to be making those claims. This allegation is based on a redacted declaration of a former electronic intelligence analyst who had worked in the military, the 305th Military Intelligence Service. And there's another affidavit here, an affiant named Redacted for security reasons, alleges that the software used by Dominion was designed by the Venezuelan government for the specific purpose to rig elections. Those were some of the things that she said in that conference that I found. And if you can prove that, that's the kind of cleaning, the deep cleaning we need that will pay off down the road if that is actually what's going on here. So that's one of about 30. Here's another one. The vote tallies produced by the Dominion machines can be manipulated by inputting a malicious code. So she's alleging that the voting machines have activity logs that can be overwritten. Again, that would be a violation of some law between. Here's another one. These are part of her 30 allegations. Between almost 31,000 and 39,000 absentee ballots were returned by Republican voters, but were not counted, according to an analysis by an expert witness. And there are more here. I mean, I don't want to necessarily, let's see, one batch, this is specifically disturbing too. Many batches were 100% for Biden, which never happens. One witness had alleged these, one batch of ballots was suspiciously pristine, meaning, and they were almost all for Biden. By that, you know, the ballots were mailed out and they were folded, and there are allegations that some ballots had come back, without a fold, or fold in the wrong place. And there are some ballots that came back with no down ballot votes. I think this was in Pennsylvania, just were all Biden and no down ticket voting whatsoever. So very, very suspicious in that regard. That Kraken on steroids is now in front of the Georgia court. As a matter of fact, Georgia had ruled on this. District Judge Timothy Batten was his name, and he is overseeing this case. he's not helping, all right? He came out with a ruling that said, all right, let's hold off on certifying the Georgia elections. And then a little later on, he reversed himself. Okay, let's not hold off. And then a little later on, he reversed himself. again. So he's not helping in this regard, but this federal judge, what stands right now is that officials are barred from wiping or altering the Dominion voting machines used in the November election. They were getting set to do that because they've got this Georgia Senate election upcoming here. Two seats and the majority of the power in the Senate to be decided there. Two runoff elections. Those are going on. We've been talking about them. We'll kind of maybe get into them a little bit. Very, very key for our country. But those to be decided here on January 5th. And so what they were going to do in Georgia was wipe the machines and clean the machines in getting ready for that next election. And that would have made it real hard to prove any kind of these allegations. So the order that stands right now from this judge is that Georgia is prohibited from wiping or resetting those voting machines. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has overturned a previous judge who decided to block the certification of the election results. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and this happened Saturday, overturned a lower court's order blocking election officials from certifying the results of the 2020 election. The court also dismissed the case with prejudice, meaning it may be able to go forward here again. This is involving a lawsuit that's not necessarily connected to President Trump. This is a group of, and they're going to be Republican politicians who had filed as a group Kelly versus the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania regarding Act 77, which is a law that made voting by mail without an excuse legal in Pennsylvania. They claim it violates the state's constitution. And in Pennsylvania, they have restrictions, very strict limitations on absentee voting prescribed in the Pennsylvania Constitution. And what this group is saying, they're saying that Act 77, which was a law that basically said, because we've got a pandemic, you can vote any way you want. All right, I summarized that in my own words. They're saying that's unconstitutional. That case to be decided yet, but that is not going to stop Pennsylvania from certifying the election results. That's a new one down the pike from there as well. And then finally, a Nevada judge has agreed to hear the Trump campaign evidence on alleged voter fraud. As I mentioned earlier, this evidentiary hearing on December 3rd, up to 15 witnesses. And these are all the affiants. They've signed these affidavits. These are people who are going to testify to witnessing illegal wrongdoing, basically whistleblower kind of stuff. So at least there's a court that's going to start hearing some of this evidentiary evidence, I guess, have an evidentiary hearing and hear this evidence on December 3rd. So that's going to move that along a little bit. That's our update because this election is really not decided still. There's a lot to keep track of there, and we'll follow it on. I'm going to move on next to, dang it, I wanted to talk about the Supreme Court ruling, too. That came down late Wednesday. It granted requests from the Roman Catholic Diocese in New York to block the enforcement of prohibitions against religious services there. Don't have time for that now because we're going to move on next. And as I mentioned early on, we're talking frequently in Montana about the pressures that we have in growth. A lot of people are coming into the state, and there's more and more pressure on our farming and ranching community to develop the land instead of continue to work the land. And there's a lot of groups out there encouraging this movement to keep your lands working. It's going to benefit communities. It's going to benefit wildlife. We talk more on that end here as we come on back. Cole Mannix will join us. From Montana, for Montana, this is Voices of Montana. Continuing on here, maybe it's I get on my soapbox a little bit when it comes to preserving Montana values as we see our state transition to what we don't know. We know that a lot of our natural resources are that industry. There's a lot of obstacles in front of them. They're not bringing in the tax base that they once had. Our ag has always been there for us. It's the backbone of our industry in Montana. It's the backbone of our culture and our ways here. And as we have talked over the years, and welcome back, I'm Tom Schultz, Voices of Montana. As we have talked over a year and a half here, concerned about those cultural values transitioning or even going away. I know a lot of people have talked about that. We look at our small communities and they're getting smaller all the time. What do you do to revitalize them? What do you do to keep working lands working? And that's what we're talking about here today with Cole Mannix. Cole is a private consultant. He had worked with various groups, but right now, as I see, a member of the Grizzly Bear Advisory Committee, but also part of this private land / public wildlife council with the FWP, and there's some meetings going on that's going to get some feedback to help. I love this question, Cole, that your associate, Lee Bartholomew, wrote this op-ed encouraging people to take part in this discussion. And he says here, it's just a point-blank question. How does the state of Montana better support the working lands that support wildlife movement and migration? What is working? What do landowners need to do more? What does the conservation community need to do more? Thank you for being here, Cole. I appreciate that. Let's, as he sets that up, let's talk about this meeting that you're going to have where people can give their feedback to help answer these questions.
Yeah, so I've been a part of a coalition over the last couple of years that has worked closely with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And that coalition has been kind of dedicated to the question of how do we approach migration and wildlife movement in the state? And one of the things that the coalition, which is made up of landowner groups and sportsman groups and conservation groups, one of the things that the coalition really agreed on was that the state really needs to reach out to the working lands, to the landowners, to the local people as it thinks about its management of migrations. And, you know, one of the reasons is that two-thirds of the state is private land, and even more of the state, even a higher proportion, is working lands when you think about leased public lands that are still productive and part of agricultural operations. And so the meeting that's coming up tomorrow, there is a governor-appointed private lands public wildlife council in the state, and the job of that council is to advise the governor and the legislature about issues that hunters, landowners, and anglers care about, particularly the overlap between private and public land. And so this council tomorrow will hear from rancher and farmer and forestry representatives from areas across the state where migration is important. And it'll hear from those folks, you know, what is their perspective on this, on how the state approaches migration? How can they be better supported by Montana? Both in terms of what's going well and also some of the challenges that they face. So that'll be tomorrow. It'll be YouTube live streamed to the public, and people can find that live stream link by simply Googling private lands, public wildlife, council, fish, wildlife, and parks, and that'll take them to the agenda if they want to listen in.
Yeah, there's quite an agenda here, too, and you know, wildlife and transportation, the governor's Grizzly Bear Advisory Council. You'll be doing a landowner panel, which I appreciate an awful lot. I spoke with Lee here earlier this morning, Lee Bartholomew, president of the Ranchers Stewardship Alliance, as I mentioned. You know, wrote this op-ed, being a part of this council, encouraging people to be here. He's been in the Phillips County and the Highline area for a lot of years. He had talked about, he manages 25,000 acres up there, and they're not all his, but the migration of wildlife, you can see this. Talk about why. You know, how long have you guys been looking at the migration of wildlife as an issue that we need to kind of straighten out with our landowners?
Well, migration has become it's something that people have been aware of for a long time to varying degrees, but it's something that has become sort of more into public awareness as GPS collars have become cheap enough that we can, attach them to, let's say, a pronghorn or a mule deer and an elk and see how far some of these animals travel seasonally to meet their nutritional needs with the change in seasons. And so it's become sort of easier to represent on a computer or on a digitally with being able to follow these GPS dots. So that's part of why there's a new awareness. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and state wildlife agencies in general have had to think about, excuse me, and manage migration and wildlife movement generally for a long time. But the ability to see via GPS how far these animals actually travel has kind of made it more vivid. And in 2018, then Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, issued a secretarial order, 3362, which was about conserving big game migrations in particular, and it provided funding for state wildlife agencies and also for private entities, nonprofits, to do research on migration and to do conservation projects. And actually, Leo Barthelmess leads a group called the Rancher Stewardship Alliance, which is one of the private entities that got one of those grants. And they have been leading grassland restoration work, wildlife-friendly fencing efforts. And so it's not just that Montana needs the feedback of folks who manage working lands. It's also that some of those people are leading conservation work on behalf of migrations. And so Leo's a good example of that with the Rancher Stewardship Alliance. And there's a lot of other collaborative groups at the local level that are doing this. The group in Winnet called ACES.
Yeah.
There's a group called the Ruby Valley Strategic Alliance, the Blackfoot Challenge, the Big Old Watershed Committee. There's many groups like this that are actually leading conservation work across the state.
You know, and ranchers have been the original stewards of the land, farmers and ranchers, for years and years. And then we've gotten into this, lawsuit-happy society to a certain degree where you've got cooperation. You've got competition instead of cooperation. And this is what I like about some of these working groups. They're trying to put that aside and get some things done on the ground. So we'll talk when we come on back after these headline break about some of those things that you are doing specifically on the ground. And we'll talk about working lands, and we'll talk about preserving our Montana way of life here after these headlines from Brian Bennett.
Specialists from the Sustainable Agriculture Program of the National Center for Appropriate Technology are available to help farmers and ranchers apply for assistance through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. It is almost $14 billion available to help almost every form of agricultural business impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The program known as Traffic Incident Management is a federally administered program known as TIM. It teaches first responders how to work safely on the highway, provide safe passage to the motoring public, and reduce interruptions to the flow of traffic. About 50% of first responders in Montana have received TIM training. The Wrangler National Rodeo Finals kick off Thursday from Arlington, Texas, and Derek Burton will be providing the NFR reports daily to many of these Voices of Montana radio stations. 15 regional cowboys and cowgirls will be competing this year. With Montana News Headlines, I'm Brian Bennett.
Cole Maddox is with us, a conservation and ranching consultant. Family grew up in the Helmville area, fifth generation Montanan. He grew up raising livestock and ranching in that area as well. Undergraduate degrees in biology and philosophy at Carroll College, and then earned a master's in theology at Boston College. Taught at his alma mater, and then returned to work in ag full-time. That's the bio I had for you, Cole. You guys still working that ranch?
Yeah, my mom and dad and aunts and uncles and my siblings and cousins all manage that place together.
Yeah, it's nice to get out there, I bet, once in a while.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world.
All right, I've only got 2 minutes in this segment because we've got a farm update upcoming here. Let's define something first. What does working lands mean?
I'd simply say that working lands is being productive, meeting some kind of food and fiber need that society has. Using land, we've got to use land that way. And so that might be livestock, it might be crops, it might be forestry, some kind of a use of our renewable resources.
And they're generally working with private landowners. I guess that would be
that's
only
right.
Working with private landowners, because land that's owned by the state or the feds is not necessarily working lands. Or is there a piece there that I'm missing?
Well, I would say that generally the working lands businesses are private businesses, and they're operated by, you know, ranchers, farmers, foresters. But much of the land that those businesses rely on and help to take care of is publicly owned. So you take, if you just imagine Montana and the two-thirds of the state, roughly, that is private land, there's much more of the state, you know, many hundreds of thousands of additional acres that are publicly owned but still working. They're part of agricultural production. So we certainly utilize, for example, U.S. Forest Service lands as part of agricultural productivity.
Well, and you almost have to. That's part of the landscape that we're in here. Let's see. I've got a breakup coming. Can you give me a 20-second example of things that are working that we can talk about after the break?
Yeah, I think that if you take so much of this, for example, native grassland in Montana where people are running cattle productively and making a good living, at the same time, those same grasslands are critical habitat for birds and migratory animals, and that's a win-win.
All right, Cole Mannix back with more here as we explore that topic on Voices of Montana.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 1-866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana, with Tom Schultz.
Great to have you joining us. Hope things are going your way today. Tom Schultz alongside. When big game moves, they move a long ways. You look at the pronghorn antelope, and they're only found in North America. They're not real big, you know, as much as 150 pounds, some around 90, but they are a fun species to hunt, and they move a long ways. They go all the way from the southern part of Canada to the northern part of Mexico, and a lot of places in between includes Montana. We are talking today about working lands in Montana and how big game will migrate through these working lands, and what the farmers and the ranchers do makes a difference not only for the health of the land but for the health of wildlife. And there are organizations that have come together. Instead of being combative in court, they are working more cooperatively, the stakeholders being the landowners for the most part, and conservation groups or hunting groups, so to speak. And there's a meeting tomorrow that Cole Mannix has set up, and we'll talk more about here, to help facilitate the conversation, communication between the landowners on what they need and what's going to help the wildlife. And Cole's with us here today on Voices. Cole, thank you so much for being here. You talked about some of the things that are working out there. As we talked about earlier on, you know, what do landowners need more help with? What ideas out there are working? Grasslands are a huge one. What kind of programs are out there that have been making a difference and you're very encouraged about?
Well, I would say even more than programs, it's the sort of it's local work together. And that work might be run by conservation districts, which are spread out across the state, or they might be run by watershed groups. Often the two sorts of groups are fairly similar, and they would, depending on what watershed you're talking about, that's kind of where all the local work happens. And it's a place where agency representatives, let's say it might be your local fish, wildlife and parks biologist, and let's say your local natural resources conservation service representative, maybe a representative from a nonprofit that's invested in that landscape. Think of the Nature Conservancy, or think of a state nonprofit. It's where those folks can go at a regular, often weekly or monthly meeting to meet with landowners and local folks who care about that landscape in common. And it's a sort of a clearinghouse for information. It's a place to vision the future of the landscape. And then it's often those little groups that are leading stream restoration work, or who are, in the case of migrations, leading work to replace fencing that was not allowing animals to migrate, with fencing that still keeps cattle and livestock in, but does allow, let's say, pronghorn, mule deer, elk to move across much easier.
And that's
so it's those local entities that are often just a very effective hub for conservation work.
Right, and they can
work that affects the future of their landscapes.
They can do a ton of different things, too. As I mentioned, talking with Leo Barthelmess earlier this morning, he's a landowner in the Highline area, president of the Ranchers Stewardship Alliance. He had talked about one of the things that they were doing locally was raising that bottom line along fencing to help animals. And even in some areas where, as you sort of had mentioned, there's no pressure for cattle or grazing, they'll leave fences open. So there must be a ton of different little things like that going on.
There's a ton of that work going on. And, you know, I think it's easy for folks. You can think of yourself if you live in town, like I do, frankly, you know, Helena, Bozeman, Missoula, think of our population centers. You can think of yourself as a conservationist. You can enjoy, let's say, recreating on public land. You can be a hunter. And yet you can still, in other ways, very much not support conservation. So you can, you know, we all have to eat, but so many of us are pretty much reliant for our food on corn and soy. And if you look at the production behind those foods, if you look at sort of the monoculture use of land that requires, there's not a lot of wildlife. There's not a lot of migrations in, let's say, the breadbasket of our country anymore, the Midwest. You know, we call that flyover country for a reason. And so you can, you know, as an eater and as a consumer, our behavior can be really disconnected from supporting the kind of land that, you know, that we have in Montana, which is both at the same time it's productive and it's supporting these, you know, iconic wildlife movements that are also part of what we're really proud of on the state. So we can kind of, there is a way to have your cake and eat it too.
Right. And it's, and I always appreciate that kind of thinking, because you work toward more broader based solutions, or they might be harder on one end. It's not the low hanging fruit. But I think landowners might be getting, I wouldn't want to say the short side of this, but, you know, it's always sort of on them to improve their lands, and it costs money. Or you get these two groups, Cole, who on one hand, you had the kind of extreme environmentalists who really wouldn't, they want to come in and tell you what you can do with your land to help this wildlife. Is that passing a little bit? I see more and more of the language called working lands, and I see more and more of the groups talk about stewardship and working together. Are we getting away from the suit happy extreme environmentalism?
You know, I think that, I do think we're getting there. I think things have improved. But we have a long ways to go. And I would suggest that it's, you know, the future of conservation is more and more with local collaborative groups and conservation districts than it is with political advocacy and lawsuits.
From your words to God's ears, you know, I think we've run into a lot of trouble. And, of course, we've talked about it here, too. I don't want to get into it. You know, they use that that lawsuit model as a fundraising formula. But let's talk about back here, the working lands. Is there, in your mind, do people feel like maybe I'm feeling here, and I don't want to make it too personal, but I really worry about keeping our culture, our way of life, our values here, you know, hard work, get up in the morning, personally responsible. You know, did you shut the gate behind you? Did you get out in the North 40 and feed the cows out there? Those kind of values that we associate with our rural communities or our ag upbringing, I worry that we're at risk of losing those values with what we're facing in terms of rapid growth in Montana. What do you guys, does that come up in the group and the circles that you're talking with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the nice things about working lands is it sort of forces you to be pragmatic and practical. And so if you're interested in preserving migrations and you go talk to a rancher or a farmer about what matters to them, it's really going to open your eyes. It's something that takes time and attention and expense to manage land in a way that works for wildlife. And so if you're a business and you've got to, you know, stay in the black, you've got to make sure that you can cover those expenses. But there's, there's not a lot of ways to make money from wildlife. Oftentimes, wildlife are an expense and a cost to an operation. You know, we don't sell wildlife for meat. That's not a way to support your family if you're a rancher or a farmer. And if you're a rancher or a farmer, it's pretty difficult to sell the rights to hunting in a way that allows you to make a living in Montana. And we've set that up as a state for a reason. Folks want to be able to hunt and access private land as part of their recreation, and they don't want landowners to make their living that way. And so what that means is that there's a lot of landowners who voluntarily allow folks to hunt. There's a lot of landowners who do conservation work on behalf of wildlife, but generally that's something that they're giving extra of their time. They're spending money on these concerns, even though they don't have a way of recovering that money with some revenue stream. And so if you want to preserve migrations, at the very minimum, people need to acknowledge that this is something ranchers, farmers, foresters are sort of doing voluntarily.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you want your agencies to be able to work well with those ranchers and farmers, that it's really important that that agencies and conservation groups seek their feedback, so that they have a good sense for how can we help in our management and our advocacy and in our bringing recognition to folks. How can we be helpful rather than a challenge?
Let's talk grizzly bears, because antelope are one thing. Okay, grizzly bears are another. And so we'll come on back at Cole Mannix. He's a member of the Grizzly Bear Advisory Council, also of the Private Land Public Wildlife Council. We'll talk about this meeting they are hosting tomorrow to get input. Preserving our Montana way of life. We talk about that in a lot of ways today. It's about keeping working lands working in our landscape. As Cole Mannix had said, about two-thirds of our lands in Montana are private and big swaths. And sometimes the ranchers are original stewards of the land, ranchers and farmers. We'll have to go to great measures to protect or encourage wildlife, especially migrating wildlife. Cole Mannix here again, a consultant and a conservation and ranching consultant. As I mentioned, a group in Montana does enjoy playing a little guitar, a little banjo, a little hiking, a little hunting, and is with us here. Cole, I wanted to get right into it before we run out of time here. You know, it's one thing when you are encouraging migrating antelope. It's an entirely different thing when you're talking about a grizzly bear, because when you have a grizzly bear on your property, you're worried about personal safety. I mean, it just changes everything. How does this conversation then change when we talk about migrating dangerous wildlife?
Well, I think that it's probably not quite correct to apply migration to grizzly bears, but certainly it's hard to separate one kind of wildlife movement from another, and grizzly bears are a critter that is expanding their population and their range in the state. And so on a separate matter, I had been a part of the governor's Grizzly Bear Advisory Council over the last year, which really looks at how can we be more prepared for the movement of grizzly bears, what can we do out front to reduce conflicts before they happen, and then how can we make sure that, particularly on working lands, that we're also providing adequate compensation to folks whose businesses are being affected by grizzly bears. How are we making sure that our agencies, both state and federal, are responsive and able to help working lands basically deal with the challenges that grizzly bears bring? The priority areas that Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has established surrounding migrations were unrelated to grizzly bears. I want to make that clear.
Oh, okay.
The priority areas are really in response to, again, the secretarial order that Ryan Zinke, then head of the Department of Interior, established, which provided funding to do research and conservation projects related to big game. And so really those five priority areas, Northwest Montana, the Rocky Mountain Front, the Malta area, the Paradise Valley, the Big Hole and Upper Clark Fork, are those five areas. That's sort of where Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has the best data on big game movement, and would like to continue to augment the data it has.
if your group is successful, and again, this meeting for input, especially if you're from those priority areas, is tomorrow. It's public comment, part of the private land / public wildlife council, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. There's a phone number here. Look at, call me if you don't get it. There's a meeting password, or you can look it up, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. If you want to be a part of this and can't find out how, you give me a call here, okay? Just, what do we got? About a minute left. Let me ask you this, Cole. If groups are successful, if working lands and, you know, farmers and ranchers work better, being in cooperative agreement versus being compelled to do things with the conservation movement, what are we going to see in Montana?
You know, if we're doing this right, you're going to see ranches, farms, forests, you're going to see those operations be profitable. And at the same time, you're going to see wildlife continue to thrive in the state. You're going to see a landscape that continues to be open and beautiful and still productive. Having those two things at the same time is really critical.
That's good. that's what you want. When you talked about a win-win, that's what we're in it for. Cole Mannix, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. We'll see you down the road, okay?
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, Cole, again, a conservation and ranching private consultant. For Josh Rath, our most excellent in-studio engineer, I'm Tom Schultz. Thank you so much for being us. We'll see you tomorrow for more of Voices of Montana.
You've been listening to Voices of Montana. Comments and opinions heard are those of the host or callers, and not necessarily those of this station, sponsors, or Northern News Network. Join us Monday through Friday at 9:06 for Voices of Montana.